2017, I think. We were up playing Glasgow, coincidentally.
Yeah, yeah.
And just had a bit of a like head knock, but not a concussive head knock, like literally just a bang on the back of my neck. So I didn't really think about it. At the time, didn't have any symptoms. And then we flew home at night, went to the missus' house, stayed there. Just, you know, was completely fine, just a bit dormy after a game. Woke up in the morning and then, yeah, came downstairs, had a bit of a stretch off the aches and pains of scrummaging, and yeah, collapsed and had a, they call it like a mini stroke essentially.
Turn your coffee. Sip of the coffee.
Right.
Sure?
Yeah.
I would say what drop we're having there. Bradley Thayer, how are you doing, brother?
I'm good, thank you, Beth. Nice to be in Wales.
Mate, you're in Godstown as well. You're in Bridgend. First and foremost, before we start, just a massive shout out to Kane and Rye. Dan Apsey's done an amazing job and set us up in this beautiful spot here. And, you know, it's a credit to him and it's nice.
Very good spot.
I'm extremely happy with it. But, yeah, thank you so much. So if anyone's in the Bridgend area, check out Kane and Rye, or you've got... well, he's got La Cucina next door, and he's opening up another shop next door. So he's part owner of half of Bridgend. Brother, how are you doing, more importantly?
I'm very good. Yeah, 2 weeks post off, so relatively positive mindset at the moment.
What have you had done?
Cartilage clear out, endoscope something or other. And then, yeah, some PRP injections along the way. So, yeah, unfortunate, but...
How did you do it? Just the knee surgery injury, I mean?
Literally playing. We had a bit of a game against each other. One of our games got called off after it'd been postponed. So, yeah, literally unfortunate. I had to put a bit of a shot on and then paid the price after, obviously. Yeah.
So what, the knee locked, is that what you're saying? Or?
Yeah, so I think it was a bit of a tear and bone on bone, basically. So cartilage kind of tore a bit of a hole. Mm. And then, yeah, had a bit of a clean up and removed the flap, as they said.
Yeah. Was it a buck on, not a bucket handle tear, was it? No.
No, I don't think so, but you just had a hole. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah, take it off.
We were talking about this before, though. Like, I wonder how many years you've been playing rugby now altogether, from the age of probably 7, 8?
Yeah, I think it started about 8 or 9, and then, yeah, so not 21 years, actually.
Yeah, and you just think about that, right? The body is always going to have some knocks and niggles. And I think, imagine if anyone had a scan right now. Yeah. They'd have so many floating bodies in the joints, cartilages and stuff like that. But for you to go all your whole career, I know you've had a couple of other scares, but I mean, on a surgery base, like you've gone most of your career, you're 30 now, and your first surgery, like official, that's, you know, touch wood.
Yeah. I'm very lucky so far.
I'd swap your life for mine when it comes to injuries, mate.
Yeah. No, I think the less you scan, the better when you get to my age. Mm.
There was a Tongan lady I used to coach in Australia, and she broke her leg. She broke her leg, and she refused to go get a scan because she didn't want to know the verdict. So all she did was, I know Fijians do it a lot, but they put this leaf around the broken area, like a cast, and they'll like do it, hold it, and it like somehow this leaf, and Fijians, if they're listening now, they'll know straight away what I'm on about, but it's like a leaf that helps your bones recover quicker.
Okay, like an anti-inflammatory.
Do you remember the winger who used to play for the All Blacks? He was like Fijian heritage, and he broke his arm before the World Cup of British Lions.
Like Rokokoko, like Sivavatu.
Older than him. It was like, not old. I mean, he was before that. Like,
before them. No,
so he, sure. Basically, I'm pretty sure he broke his arm or his leg. And they said, like, you're going to be in a cast for like 6 to 8 weeks. And he was like, oh, just let me fly back to the islands of Fiji. And literally, he was back within 2 weeks from this leaf. And I've known loads of people. So it's a crazy.
Yeah. Mate, this, yeah. Never underestimate what nature can do, like. But
yeah,
there's a tight end from Cardiff, Tongan guy, Fau Felice, tore his, I think it was his pec, tore his pec off a bone. Went back to Tonga in pre-season, came back about 4 weeks later, had lost like 2% body fat, put on like 5 kilos of muscle, and his pec was looking as good as new. And you're like, hey, what have you been eating?
Makes you think, didn't it? Because... like, what is it they're eating and what is it they're doing?
I don't know. Mate, it's working though. So, yeah, give me some of that.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on like natural remedies and stuff now? Like, I try to avoid any form of medicine that's not really.
I try not to do it. Obviously, there's times where you'll do, especially playing rugby, kind of pain management is tough. But when you've done everything you can, like the ice bath thing we were talking about earlier, you know, you're kind of natural anti-inflammatories, like omegas and stuff. When you've done all you can, then I think it's maybe, then you look at it and say, like, is it worth doing this now? And nothing major, you know, like an anti-inflamm or like a paracetamol or, but like, yeah, I'm quite, if I can do everything natural, then yeah, we'll work from there. But just look after yourself first, isn't it, before you start putting stuff in.
Well, I know from you, man, like, we've been doing a little bit of work for some time now, but like, you're probably one of the most meticulous, like, driven people when it comes to doing all the little 1%ers right, and that's probably part of the reason why your body has been working well for you over the years.
Yeah.
But you know, from a valley boy from Estradonna, is that right?
From Tylerstown, yeah. Estradonna's my club. Yeah.
So I met you back in the day, but I remember you more importantly when we played league together.
Yeah.
Because you were in that cusp of Crusaders or going to the Blues, so that's
I think we were about 18, weren't we? It's when the Crusaders were involved in the Super League, was it, at the time? So yeah, we had a bit of a judgment day. Had to choose which way we're going to go, and yeah, obviously chose Union in the end. But yeah, you stuck with league. Did all right, to be fair. So it was
good times. Do you ever question if you did go down the league path?
No, I don't think so, because that was all I knew really was Union. I enjoyed league because it was like a fresh start almost. You don't get any labels, do you? When you start a new sport, you learn it kind of fresh, and we had good skill sets from Union. It was a small group of us from the same school, me, Sean Webber,
Davis. Alex was there, he's a bit older than us.
Yeah, a bit older. We played you, obviously, Rodri.
Rodri, yeah. Reece Watkins.
So it was we had a good core, didn't we?
Yeah, we had a good little bunch.
But yeah, no, I don't think I regret choosing Union. I've obviously done okay out of it in terms of a career so far. So
When you go, well, you've definitely done well and you still continue, you know, at the moment you're at the, is it Ealing?
Ealing Trailfinders.
Yeah. How are you finding that?
It's good. It's different to Cardiff, where I knew everything and everyone. So like, starting fresh has been a challenge, but quite a nice change. You kind of reevaluate yourself and where you want to go and your goals, as obviously working with yourself, it's been quite insightful, because you start doing things a little bit differently when you're in a different place. But I've enjoyed it so far, and yeah, obviously bad timing with the injury, but starting the season now, but hopefully it can kick on a bit once we're back, so we're playing a bit more regularly.
You know, one thing I find quite interesting, and like, I'm gonna be mindful how I talk, because I talk to you on a regular basis, so I'm gonna talk as if I don't know anything about you. But I think sometimes going to a new club is like, gives you a new lease on life. And you know, you've been at Cardiff before that for like, what, 11 years?
Yeah, since 18.
So it's like, sometimes having that change can give you a change of perspective on how you approach a game or how you envision yourself playing now.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think when you stay in one place, sometimes you establish a bit of an identity for yourself, and then you keep kind of reinforcing it them, and you know, you ask for feedback, but in your head you kind of, you already know what they're going to say, and you're working with similar coaches. So I think moving gave me a fresh perspective, and definitely the things that I thought I was okay at, I've even reevaluated those, because you can always get a bit better. There's always a different way of doing it. But yeah, Ealing has been a bit of a fresh slate for me in terms of goal setting, and then just changing my own perception of the player I am. And, good.
It's good, mate. It's good. It's been amazing for me. Like, working with you has given me a new perspective on just how much it actually takes to be good, but then taking yourself to that extra 1 or 2%. And the goals that we've set out and you've set out, and you've, like, obviously you've had this roadblock right now, but you know, the mindset that you've got now on adversities, injuries and setbacks is totally different. Like, you're going there now, I'm going to prove prove you wrong, instead of like maybe at Cardiff being there for so long and having Dai Young as a coach at one stage, you probably knew what he was going to say before he said it.
Yeah.
And you're like, here we go.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you just, like you said, you get into that routine of knowing, yeah, okay, team list is going to come soon. What's the difference now? And
yeah,
you know what I mean? But, and yeah, I think your whole outlook on it all is totally different.
Yeah. Second that. You definitely, you almost give yourself so much self-doubt when you don't change that, because of all the like past experiences and past feedback and then it's been good because it's been a fresh perspective for me, but somebody else has also got somebody new to look at that they've never seen before, with nothing, you know, to base any decisions on, which has been, you know, beneficial. Going up there and challenging, you know, I had literally first week at a fitness test, and somebody set, as head of S&C, set me a target that was like something you'd never write down as a prop in Wales, and I'm like, I've got to do it, and that whole self doubt come in straight away, and then yeah, obviously we were talking at the time, and yeah, it was quite nice to.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, be a prover wronger.
Yeah, yeah. What, as in, did he set a goal like for a Ford that, which isn't normally set for Fords? Was that what you said?
Yeah, so I had like a Bronco time, which, you know, would be for a 30-year-old prop who's already played like 12 years of rugby or whatever, wouldn't be like a common thing to ask of somebody, especially if you didn't have anything to base it on.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's obviously done his research, to be fair to him, found out a little bit about me, which I didn't know at the time, and just come to me and said, look, we want you to do this. This is the type of player we want you to become here, and this is why. But he told me this after, so I turned up first day nerves, and then you do it, and you just get on with it. So yeah, that was probably the whole springboard then of like, don't put your limits on yourself too early.
Yeah, yeah. I seen something the other day, right, about, remember Dylan Hartley?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it, and he was talking about how he kind of came through the era where he was like, it was professional but amateur, but then he, Eddie Jones became the England coach, and he said, I'm going to make you captain. He said, you're not the most skillful, you're not the best player, but you're the hardest worker. And he's like, and I know you're the oldest in the team, but I'm going to actually make you train harder now than you've ever trained at 30 something. And that's probably part of the reason why he buckled. I think it was after the World Cup, or just before the World Cup, he didn't make it.
Yeah.
But he was saying how he was doing more training then than he was when he was younger, because he took this limitation off what he could do, or what a 30 plus year old player should be doing.
Yeah.
You know, and do you think that's been dividends for you now since?
I think so. I think like taking everything else out of the picture and just having a clean slate to kind of set new limitations, set new goals. Nobody's already made a decision on you. And you know, I'm sure it's the same for other players that have joined new clubs. You always add something to your game, because you learn something from, you know, people you've never played with, you know, coaches you've never had before. So I think for me anyway, it was a chance to kind of get a little bit better, in whatever way. And you know, that was obviously S&C for pre-season, as it always is. It's always been a graft, isn't it? But like, yeah, even in the gym, just knowing what I could do in Cardiff and what people expected, and then going to London, a place where you want to impress, and you're around other people who are competitive. That's probably one of the biggest things I've seen in London now, is how competitive people are and how it's encouraged. So maybe in Wales we have our pecking order, and we're sometimes afraid to challenge it, whereas obviously it's a very competitive club in England. There's a lot of players who probably got a bit of a chip on their shoulder because they want to be playing higher level and want to take the club on, and that's almost fed into itself then, because you've got these ultra competitive rugby players who are now competing, you know, and pushing themselves, being pushed by each other subconsciously, because you know, you don't say a lot, but yeah, you get new things out of yourself. Definitely,
that's good to you, and I think change is good like that. And you know, obviously Ealing, you've got a lot of ex internationals in there. You got, I think, Billy 12 Trees in there. You've got Lloyd Williams.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think the other guys you got in there, but they're the ones. Who's the fly half? Shingler.
Shingler, yeah, Steve Shingler.
Did he play a cap or two for Wales?
Yeah, he was involved with Scotland. He was, yeah,
Scotland, that's right. Yeah,
but obviously, as a bit of a stalwart in Ealing now, but there's a very, you know, respected background in regional rugby with London Irish as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And leads very well up in Ealing, to be fair to him. So you have these players who have been there, done it, and still want to kick on and want to help this club to reach its potential, to be fair. Yeah. And then you've got a lot of young players who are ridiculously competitive, maybe didn't quite make it a prem team, but given this kind of opportunity and opportunity to showcase themselves there in a championship level, you think, look, this guy could definitely do a job.
Yeah, yeah.
At a higher level, and yeah, just waiting for their opportunity, you know,
to kick on. Do you think, you know, I think that the championship, the league's called, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think that championship league is a sweet spot for people because you've seen people go into that league and just springboard into Premiership rugby or springboard back into the Welsh URC league and really level up. Because I think comfort in, like anything, right, it's like comfort is good, but it's not good.
Yeah.
Because I've said it a couple of times on a podcast. It's a scenario about Jordan Peterson. I think I might have mentioned the mice thing.
Yeah.
And I'll say it again just for listeners. But like, essentially, like, you know, fear sometimes is we step away from fear because it's not normal. It's not nice to be in that area. But then fear essentially is like if you had, they did this test on these mice and they put coils, like spring coils on their tails and tied it to a wall. And they put a block of cheese in front of him. And all the mice were already fairly full already. And the block of cheese was there. And they, not many of them really pulled to kind of get there. And they didn't really get to the cheese, sorry. So then what they did in the end then was put a cat behind the mice. And when they had fear behind them, it drove them to more.
Yeah.
Like them springs were at the full amount. They got the cheese and they tried to get out of there. And I think we misconcept of the fear of what fear is to us because fear essentially is going to make us better. Like how many teams have you had? Like I know for a fact, you know, when you're playing in a squad and they've just signed a guy in your position or they've loaned a guy in the middle of the season in your position. And it's like, it's like, fuck, what's the coach think of me?
Yeah.
Does he not value me enough? And then B, it's like, well, I know I got to step up.
Yeah.
And that is fear. Oh, that is that's the cat behind us. And I think we need fear. So, like, you know, some people I know, well, we all know them. They're probably in a club. They've been there for so long, they've got comfortable. And they're not hitting their potential anymore. They're, like, coasting.
Yeah.
They're doing just enough. And, I think there's a lot of Welsh players who could kick on further.
Oh, definitely. I think we're afraid sometimes we need to get out of our comfort zone. And particularly in Wales, it's a very small goldfish bowl.
Yeah.
Welsh rugby. But getting that uncomfortable, finding that uncomfortable place then makes us fear failure. Like you're saying about selection, like the fear of not being selected, somebody coming in, like going to a new place, fear of being judged as not being good enough. I think that when we play, fear of not even putting a performance in for some people, it can be down to moments, can't it?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
If you take pride in every part of your work, I don't think you're afraid of not doing it then, and then you don't need motivation. It's the discipline to not let yourself down almost, as opposed to, you know, being comfortable, knowing everything, like, you know, myself anyway, had in Cardiff, and probably for, I don't speak for him, but like for Lloyd, who knew and ran our game in Cardiff inside out, and then to move to a new club where he played rugby a little bit differently.
Yeah.
It would have been similar, I would imagine, for him to kind of experience that as well. So, yeah, I think, you know, the fear of letting yourself down and not doing yourself justice and not being selected is way bigger motivator than, you know, the reward of winning a game, being selected next week.
It's
the, yeah, it's the one in the voice in your head, isn't it, at the end of it. But yeah, definitely fears of, for most people, I think, in sport.
Yeah.
We don't always admit it.
Yeah.
We don't always, you know, we don't want to say that loud, but yeah, it's definitely there.
Yeah.
The motive,
100%. Yeah. I think as well, like, I think Welsh people as well, we're quite, we won't back ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, we're not, I wouldn't say we're humble, but we're not a type to go walk in and tell, not even say how good we are, but like, just back ourselves. Like, yeah. we get cockiness mixed up with confidence. But I think sometimes we need to be more confident in backing ourselves and putting our balls on the line, essentially going, well, if I fuck up,
yeah.
But I'd rather try than not, and stop putting ourselves in these boxes. And like, you know, even Lewis Rees Sammet, I looked at that documentary the other day of him, and I actually really liked it. Like, he's definitely a different type of Welsh, like, yeah. Very out there, and he set for the stars type of thing. But he voiced it, he puts it out there. And yeah. We talk a lot about that, of like speaking our truth, essentially, speaking about what we want, because so many people, you know, deep down in you, they know what they want, but they're fearful of putting it out there because of being judged, looking stupid, or just fear of failure.
Yeah.
So if I was to say to you, what would your motivation be to keep on going and wanting to hit the goals that you've set?
For me, until recently, I'd never written a goal down.
Mm.
So I had goals in my head, but it was almost a fear of writing it down and not achieving it. So, like, obviously we've worked together now, put some goals together, put some time scales together. For me, I always just like to get a little bit better every day. I know it's like a bit of a cliche saying, but if I don't know something, then I'll learn about it.
Yeah,
then I'll go down that rabbit hole. And then if you can do that every day, so the same for me in rugby.
Mm.
I understand scrums, but like, even now, I pride myself on that part of it, but I don't understand everything.
Mm.
Like, you always got something you can add or somebody you can speak to. So for me, it's getting a little bit better every day. Those 1%ers, which, you know, we speak about quite often in rugby and in professional sport. And then, yeah, for me, it's about playing at the highest level I can for as long as I can.
Mm.
So hopefully with, you know, game time at Ealing, and with Ealing being the club it is, and the ambitions they have, hopefully that, you know, comes to fruition in the next year or two. But yeah, it's literally just about being better, putting a little bit better performance each week, and then before you know it, it compounds, doesn't it? And you have what you aim for on the start. So
100%. One thing I'm big, and I probably want you to kind of share, like, I know a lot of people out there are hard workers and hard trainers. We really talk about extras a lot, you know, working on more the weaknesses and the strengths. And one of the things we were focusing on a lot was actually like our ball playing, like hands-on stuff. And I think sometimes, you know, even myself at times, you know, it's easy to not do those extras. It's easy. But like you said, for people out there listening, you know, you've always been a good scrummager, but doing other things on the weakness side, like, what have you found the most benefit way of, I don't know, doing those extras, or even reaching out to people for support, as in, like, if that is grabbing a player or grabbing a coach? Like, I think sometimes we are fearful of pulling a coach aside. Hey, mate, do you mind just doing some extras with me? Like, how have you thought, how have you, like, kind of transcended that into your game and training?
So at Cardiff, we had a group of boys who, it was pretty much the same boys, you know, week in, week out, and we'd do the extras that we're in our game plan, and that were a big part of our game, which, you know, was the defensive side for me and the scrummaging side. And then having, like, reassessed when I got to Ealing, we talk about the ball playing part, and Cardiff probably wasn't particularly confident around that area of my game. I thought in the past I was, didn't think about it. And then when you get made aware of it, you know, you live up to the kind of feedback then. But yeah, going to Ealing, I just kind of started writing it down, what I was doing, just to reinforce to myself and to give me a bit more confidence around that area of my game. And then I work with our skills coach, DJ. He will, you know, most sessions we'll do 15, 20 minutes all around early catch pass, early out the backs. Sometimes it might even just be static catching, just repetitions. But then, like, writing it down, recording it, adding to it, so we kind of get a bit more, we had a defender in to add a bit more pressure. So, yeah, habit stacking then in an easy way because I'm in training every day.
Yeah.
The harder ones are the ones where we're not in training and you have to do it yourself. And they're the ones that you think, oh, this is pointless doing this. But actually, you do it 10, 15, 20 weeks in a row and you've probably got, you know, 3 or 4 hours of just, you know, one hand spin passing or like throwing the ball up in the air to myself with one hand and early catching off, you know, some of my rebounding. I know in pre-season I'd spoken to you about doing some drills in like Hyde Park. I'm like walking around Hyde Park, but that was you feel really strange, but you know what, like nobody cares, nobody gives a shit really. So for me it was about just getting that work done every day and not putting it off, because it's easy to do before training, after training, just make a routine and then kind of fit it in as soon as you can. Like, don't let it stagnate. As you just, you'll find an excuse. Even in the toughest mental people in the world, everybody's got, I'll do it later in them at some point, haven't you? So just do it before that even gets in your head. And then,
I think it's just being that leader in yourself and not letting the mind, because comfort is, our bodies seek comfort like that. Yeah. We always want to seek comfort. So we're back. So when we're talking, obviously, we're talking about this 1%ers, but I think, you know, I want to kind of delve in and go back to the Blues days as well. And, you know, you had a lot of probably people to look up to then, right? Who was one in particular that you kind of have looked up to and you like, learn off, I suppose?
For me, he was obviously the same position, but Gethin Jenkins.
Yeah.
I never really said it out loud before, but he just did his business. Was just, still is, I suppose, as a coach, just confident in what he knows and what he does. I don't know how his mind works. I don't think many people do. I've never played with him, luckily, but he's obviously got that edge to him that people sometimes like and sometimes dislike. It's, you know, but for me, it was him and being able to watch him daily and like his. We talk about the stuff that you get in early and you do your bits before you start, and like he'd be the first one in, last one out, but wouldn't tell anybody.
Just do it.
And never make a fuss of it. So that was definitely a lesson learned for me. It's just, doesn't matter how big you are, those little sacrifices then of leaving the house a bit earlier or getting home a bit later, there's no job in the world that you can escape on, really. So especially not professional sport. So
he had a pretty long career as well. How old was he when he retired?
To like 30, something.
Were you like tripping him up a train, like, mate, just fucking retire already?
Yeah. There was a couple of years, and I was like, oh, what am I going to do about it? He eventually, obviously, retired with his body, but had a very, illustrious career.
Toulon as well, is that right?
Toulon, obviously, Lions.
Lions.
140 caps for Wales, which is some feat in itself, isn't it? But
did you ever pick his brain, or was it just more watching him?
The last year, so the first maybe 4 years that I was, 3-4 years that I was full time, wouldn't even speak to him. I was just like, you know, when you're like in your head, you just think, I need to earn this guy's
respect.
So never really like spoke to him. Maybe the last year where, you know, we had the Bilbao kind of Challenge Cup win in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months of that. And I was playing regularly. I'd maybe like ask him a question and then it'd be like a little nugget of gold that he'd give you. I'd pick his brain then, and obviously now still keep in touch with him.
Cool.
Then it was just, you know, you'd ask the question when you kind of had earned the right to ask the question. It could be difficult, can't it? Every day you just,
It's I get what you're saying. I'm trying to think of the guy that I was kind of nervous to talk around. It wasn't really anyone in clubs, because I jumped for a couple of clubs in Australia. I had three clubs over there. So like before the time I got nervous, I was going.
Yeah.
But I think more coaches, I think. More coaches. We had Lee Breers once at Wales. Yeah. And he, like, in League World, he's like one of the best. He's coaching assistant coach of Brisbane Broncos now, and he's coaching assistant for England now. And I was super new. And because he's in your position, you're kind of like in awe of them.
Yeah.
You are, like, it's like, unless you're in that realm of life of rugby, you don't really get it, but it's like, you're fucking, I don't know why you're so nervous, because they could give you so much gems and golden nuggets.
Yeah.
But like, it was, you know, he was a hell of a boy as well. Like, I think he liked his partying just as much as he liked his school. But he could back it up. Hey, I could never do that. Like, I think we all know one person who could probably get on the beers in the week.
Yeah.
And have an absolute stormer. Yeah. I'm not that guy. No,
can't switch off.
I have so much anxiety about the fact of drinking and feel guilty for it that I couldn't probably. But man, I want to ask you as well a little bit about Dai Young. What was that experience like?
It's probably as a bloke, going great with Dai, but just didn't get the opportunities whilst at Cardiff last year, and you know, maybe the year before. Went to Glasgow and then worked with Danny Wilson, who I'd worked with before, and really enjoyed it and started to enjoy rugby a bit more and felt confident, appreciated there, and then kind of came back to Cardiff and obviously lost that then, because it kind of went back to where it was before I'd kind of left. So yeah, for me, I think it probably just made me realise that I was comfortable in Cardiff but wasn't actually enjoying rugby, because I enjoyed getting better, which meant playing, and I wasn't playing, which meant I was just training. And then, you know, as much as training, you know, aspects of skills can help you. For me, playing was not happening, so that was mentally tough more than anything. And obviously, Mrs. went through a fair bit of it. We lived, obviously, to live together, but we were living together full time at the time. So, yeah, for her to see it when I went to Glasgow, and then when I came back, she was just like, "Whoa, no, this isn't like you."
Totally different person.
Yeah, because I probably didn't notice it, you know, the 6 months before, because it's like a gradual kind of thing, isn't it? When things change. But going to Glasgow for 7 or 8 weeks, having that kind of new lease of life in a rugby sense, and then coming back to Cardiff and being like, right, I need to kick on with this, and then not really having the opportunities to do so. Yeah, it was frustrating, and everybody gets frustrated, and it's one man's opinion at the end of the day. But yeah, for me, it was just realization of, I'm not enjoying it because I'm not getting better. I'm not playing. I want to play with these boys.
Like,
I'd seen what the team could do when we were in that kind of Bilbao, Danny Wilson era, where we were all geared to one thing and we understood each other. It was a good culture with you know, some really good coaches, like Richard Hodges and Matt Sherratt. Obviously, Matt Sherratt's still at Cardiff now, but as a head coach. So I think that environment now will be a lot different to how it was last year. It's definitely a different approach. And
Did you outsource that loan deal? Or
no, so obviously Danny had worked with him previously. We had a quick chat over the phone, and then approached Diane. At the time, there was, you know, 4 loose heads fit at Cardiff, so probably we're going to be limited on game time. And given the previous couple of months, you know, kind of foresight, it was a start of the season, so it was a good opportunity to just go out there and get some game time, which, to be fair, Danny gave me in Glasgow, and there's a good bunch of boys up there as well. So
it's good, mate.
Yeah.
It's good, and I'm glad where you are now today, because you've learned a lot about it. But, you know, there was a really serious moment that probably could have, well, a lot of people were retired from what you went through. Do you want to share a little bit on that? What year that was?
So this is 2017. I know which year it was, because we started a coffee company the same year. But it was like January 2017, I think. We were up playing Glasgow, coincidentally.
Yeah, yeah.
And just had a bit of a, like, head knock, but not a concussive head knock, like literally just a bang on the back of my neck. So I didn't really think about it. At the time, didn't have any symptoms. And then we flew home that night, went to the missus' house, stayed there. Just, you know, was completely fine, just a bit dormy after a game. woke up in the morning, and then yeah, came downstairs, just had a bit of a stretch off the aches and pains of scrummaging, and yeah, collapsed and had a, they call it like a mini stroke essentially. So just a blood clot, but obviously with the blood pressure in your body, burst the clot in the artery, and then went up to the brain, and then that was, yeah, a big, big section of a career that I won't get back. And luckily, touch wood, I've been pretty injury free apart from that kind of instance. But yeah, it was a good bit of time off, but yeah, kind of gradually got back to it. And yeah, the next year was probably the most enjoyable year of rugby I played. So, you know, with Cardiff. So.
Without breezing on it, so how long were you, like, obviously, man, having a mini stroke is not no joke.
No.
Did you get advised to retire?
No. So, to be honest, it was the only, nobody ever mentioned retirement. It was always about how we could manage it and what the chances of it happening again were. So, obviously, so specialist had scans, and Gareth Jones, the doctor at the time at Cardiff, was just explained the severity of it to me, which I obviously understood. My mother's a nurse, so she's kind of, she knew what was going on. And then I saw a few specialists about it, but essentially, the artery had kind of been split. But then arteries, they have good blood flow, they repair. Once the clot had kind of passed, there was anticoagulants for about, I think it took for about 2 or 3 years after. I don't know if I needed to take them that long, but it was like a, I don't need to.
What is that, like a thinner?
Yeah, like an aspirin, essentially. Yeah, okay. Like dissolve an aspirin every morning. But yeah, kind of, obviously dark conversations with the old man and this is it. And I know it was tough for her, because when you take like rugby away from somebody that does it full time, it's, when boys retire, you see why you can go one way or the other. So yeah, for me, it was more, I need to be able to do what I kind of set out to do. Is it safe to do so?
Yeah.
And yeah, luckily it was, it was advised that there's no increased risk, and it can happen to anybody essentially, twist your neck the wrong way and you could have the same thing. So yeah, it was dark, but it was it was light, like, so.
Well, credit to you, man, because that's a big event there. What do you think got you through those moments?
I had a good support network around me, which obviously definitely helped. I had something outside of rugby, which gave me a bit of security of that this could work quite well, to prove a bit of a distraction then from this recovery. But I think at the end of it, I remember having a conversation with S&C coach Robin Sound Taylor, who was at Cardiff at the time, who was a good friend. I just said to him, like, they've kind of said it's quite bad, and I don't know if I can play rugby again. And the bit where they said they didn't know if I could play rugby again was the bit that made me realise I have to do it if I can, because I've got too much that I can't leave go. And it was just, I hadn't achieved what I wanted to achieve. It was safe to do it, and my family understood it as well, so I understood where I wanted to go with it. And then that's what I say about the support network. When they fully understood why I was doing it, knowing I already had a degree and various other things in the bag, they were like, oh, this could actually mean more than he ever let on. Next year was the year where I probably, actually kicked on in rugby, because it was the fear again of that being taken away. Just like kicks you up the ass and says, like, get your shit together.
Yeah, yeah.
This is actually what you want to do.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. It's powerful, that is, Brad. Yeah. It's really big. I know we've spoke a lot about that. And it's interesting, like you just said something then about, like, the year after was probably one of your best seasons. They say that regarding, like, cancer patients, people who have come through cancer, they've come out the other side and they're more grateful, they show more gratitude, they'll back themselves in these moments because they've kind of hit, like, a bigger scare. And they're like, well, if I can overcome that, then this is nothing.
Yeah.
Like, me really, because again, it comes back from, you know, fear of, and even in anyone, like performances, like the year after, you're playing more like you've got nothing to lose than you've got so much to, no, yeah, so much to gain. Or nothing, you're playing like you've got nothing to lose. So then the way you play the rugby then is more open-minded and free-flowing. And it's like anything, you know, so many players that they play, they make a mistake. When we make a mistake, we're like, fuck, we start looking at the bench, seeing if the boys are warming up.
Yeah.
And then you're dwelling on that mistake for 10 minutes. But when you've had that impact on you, you know, you're quick to go, if I did make a mistake, next job, who cares? Yeah. You know, that's a big philosophy, is that next job. But yeah, man, I think that alone just shows the character of you. Like, I got so much admiration for you because of who you are, your values, and like just your mindset. Like, you're extremely driven, and you know, you've got the coffee brand as well that you started in the same year. And even now with the knee injury, like we've already been talking about your business ideas and your other things you're doing on the side. Like, there's not a stop moment. You're just like, oh, well, you're always solution based.
I like to think I am. But there's obviously times where you still have self-doubt. I think I don't really know where it comes from, but just moving forward and just getting on with it. I don't think about the stroke as such, but knowing then that I couldn't do anything. And then I remember applying for jobs in the hospital bed at the time, just thinking, oh, do you know what, this could be just in case. And then get home on the Sunday and have 3 phone calls. I don't come in for an interview, and I'm like, oh shit, I'm not ready for this yet.
What was the, when you come back from the stroke, I'm glad you brought that up, like, what was your movement? Like, how much range of stuff, or could you have feel in both hands again?
So movement was pretty good. I struggled with lights for a while.
Too bright?
Yeah, like too bright, noise, like wear sunglasses in the car, which was weird because, you know, if you don't know what's happened, it does look strange. You're driving around, you know, the valleys.
Celebrity.
Yeah, the valleys in March with a pair of Ray-Bans on. You're like, what are you doing, mate?
It was top dog.
But yeah, they, in all seriousness, that movement was fine, bit of coordination.
Yeah.
So I had the bleed was in cerebellum, which is like the part of coordination.
Mm.
So left hand was kind of not, it's hard to say for definite, but because I'd never tested it before, but that was the one I just noticed I lost a bit of confidence with. So catching anything on my right side, my left hand up first, would be like, I'd be thinking about it, which is why I worked with physio at the time was Ben Warburton, and he, honestly, we didn't even have a rehab plan. We were just like, right, we're going to do everything. Wow. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know whether we were going to come back, I was going to come back or not. So fair play to him. Like, he didn't have me as a, I wasn't allocated to him, but he was just like, all right, what can we do? And he was very much like, he tailored my plan to me.
Nice.
I'd said, my left hand feels a bit weird. We were doing like catches, tennis balls, like he's lobbing balls at me.
Cool.
I was just sat out there outside playing ball against a little trampette, you know, the like crazy catch thing. So it was, but movement wise, it was okay. I was just weary and definite like concussive symptoms, and which is what we kind of thought it was at first. So yeah.
Was he with the Blues then, Warburton's brother? What's his name?
Yeah, Ben.
Ben Warburton. Yeah, they look double gangers of each other.
Yeah, they're twins, yeah.
They are twins, are they? Twins. Oh, there you go. So then.
Ben was a physio with us at the time, and then obviously has moved on now, but yeah, was there up until like last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good guy. So yeah.
Man, it's pretty cool.
He looked after me well.
So regarding that now, since the stroke, any other symptoms, or are you all fully fine now?
No, touch wood, all fully fine. I'm sure my missus would disagree, but I feel good. I keep on top of everything, and I've never had a symptom at all since.
Yeah, yeah.
Luckily. And no aspirins or anything.
Else. Good stuff.
Back to normal.
Good, good. Well, you're very, you're very thorough with everything you do, and I know that for a fact, but let's talk a little bit about Fat Dragon Coffee now. Where did the journey, where did this all stem from, and who's a part of it?
So went to Oz maybe back in, I'm trying to think how long ago, it was probably 10 years ago, so maybe like 20.
Just lift that mic up a little bit, twist it up. Yeah, there There you go. There you go. That's better.
So we went to Oz in maybe 2013, I think. I just played rugby for like 3 months, 4 months for a side called Balmain and yeah. Sydney Stars. So we went out there. Went out there and kind of obviously saw the coffee culture that was out there at the time, and didn't think anything of it. Came back to the UK, started full time with Cardiff, and then, you know, what, 3 years later that is, I'm like, we're still in Costa, we're still in Starbucks, this is shite. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when yeah, you actually yeah. think about coffee, like the love and attention that goes into it is actually by the smaller companies, like yeah. the independents. So when, obviously, I had a bit of time after the stroke, to think about it, I had like January, that whole pre-season just to put something together, and I was like, I can't do this on my own. Like, I'm not,
I had the time,
the idea, but the time that like I'm a different person to, you know, a salesperson. Mm. So at the time, I sat next to Dylan Lewis in the changing room, and he's very much the like the Dell boy character, like generally lights up a room, just walks in, just talks to anybody.
Nice.
Well, obviously charismatic, but hardworking.
Yeah.
And I see like how he conducts himself off the pitch, and he's not one to like talk about it. But so I was like, just fancy setting up a business. So we were like, yeah, well, what are we gonna do? And we kind of mulled around, and I was like, right, coffee. Like we spend a lot of time. It's almost a commodity these days. Like everybody drinks one a day. That's not everybody, but you know, there's a lot of people that drink it. So we kind of went from there, like what's the reasoning behind us starting this? And for us it was, we drink like shite coffee outside the house. We'd go away on trips to like France and South Africa, and we'd have coffees there, and we'd be like, this is like different level.
Yeah.
But finding anything in Cardiff at the time was like, you had to go into the city, you had to go looking for it. So we were like, why don't we just take it to the house, like take it to the home. So that was kind of when we started. And we made a good contact from Bridgend, actually. And we had a good chat to him. And he pointed us in the right direction to the right people. And we developed Fat Dragon Coffee now, which was basically coffee in whatever format that you needed.
Wow.
So we did the beans, we did the ground, we did the Nespresso capsules. So, yeah, it was just like, how can we make it accessible to everybody at home? And then we didn't even, you know, plan on doing any wholesale, open up a coffee shop. We knew our limits at the time were, we're professional rugby players, we don't have the knowledge, the time to like expand on this. And yeah, we just kind of left it grow organically from then.
It's been doing pretty well, man.
This is right.
We did the fat dragon. Is it because props and dragon in Wales?
Two fat blokes.
I didn't want to give it. I was waiting for you to say it, but no, it makes sense. It makes sense. It's man. To be fair, like since we've connected, I've been religiously drinking the old fat dragon coffee, mate, and it's a good drop because, like you talk about going to these other countries, like you've been to Australia and. Australians are probably the coffee snobs of the world now, and but they to be fair, their coffees are unbelievable. Yeah. And like you talk about, they're all sole traders or however you want to call it, independent coffee shops, and like they're very passionate about it. You know, there's not many chains out there, and there was a one or two Starbucks there, but like if you're going to Starbucks in Australia, there's something wrong with you. Yeah. And so it's like, you know, even over here, like I'm, you know. I'd have a Costa on the way to some office or go meeting someone, and it's just like, you know what I mean? And
same
when
old,
yeah, but you want to be passionate about your coffee, exactly, like, and you know, it's a big part of everyone's day is a coffee. You know, what do we sit over now? Like, I don't really drink, you don't drink, and
it's a social thing.
Yeah, you sit over a coffee, you know, and if you can tap into that, which you guys have done, and you're using the leverage of your profiles. Yeah. Like you said, you've got the Wales Rugby Union team. You do now. You do Harlequins. You do Edinburgh.
A bit of Glasgow.
Ealing. Yeah. And then you've got other. You know, you've got it in other areas and brands. And I seen you did a little walk around London the other day, trying to connect.
We visited Soho. So obviously, me and Dills live together in London at the moment. So our little thing on a day off is get out, review some of the coffee shops, find out what's good, what's bad. And we've just brought a third partner on board now, Ian.
Yeah, nice.
Bathworth. So he's very experienced in like managing facilities, understands coffee shop operations, which, you know, we eventually want to go into, and he's quite clued on in a lot of different areas and will ask questions and question us. So it's been good to have him on board, because we go into these places now looking at things differently. Yeah, we were very focused on the coffee, whereas, you know, you can go to any coffee shop, it's what brings you back. It's the interaction, it's the service, it's there's so much more to it that, you know, you don't put on a bag of coffee.
Mm.
So the coffee's there, the product's there. It's how we then, you know, sell it.
Yeah.
Like, I think even when we started, I said to you, what is the message behind Fat Dragon? And really, like, and that's the key, I think, in building a brand, is building the, people need to know, want to know more now about the people than ever. Like, you've got social media, which is massive. So it's like, who is this person behind the brand? Like, no one knows about Costa. No one knows about, but they're just big enough. They don't need to know about the brand. But it's like, well, these independent people need to really sell the soul out of it, you know? Like, for instance, let's just say Lavazza. I just seen a sign over there.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be more open to going to Lavazza because it sounds Italian or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just the smart, assume, oh, Italian coffee's probably good. Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. So it's like, but obviously, like, even the story of your journey, we spoke a lot about it, it's delved into that, because to be fair, right, I think everyone who's a professional athlete should have something on the side, because rugby shouldn't define us.
No.
Because it's it's just something you're good at and it's a part of you, but like there's so much more to you. But even speaking from my own experience, like when I got injured, my whole world went down, because my definition of who I was based on this. And when I played well, I felt amazing. But when I wasn't playing well, I didn't feel too good. Or if I wasn't getting picked. But then if you have got so many more strings to your bow, you know, legs of a chair. If you've got four legs of a chair and one leg falls, injury with rugby, well, I've got three other things. I've got my health. I've got my relationships. I've got my coffee brand. So, like, you've got other things to keep this chair afloat instead of just relying on that one leg of, like, a stool, for instance.
Yeah.
Then the stool goes, you're fucked.
No.
So, I think it's really big that, you know, especially these people that, you know, you're in the full-time environment. And, you know, as you know, mate, when you're in a change room, what is it you will talk about? Rugby. Yeah. Like, it's everything. Yeah.
It's 100% all the time, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's heavy at times. Like, sometimes, even, like, playing this season, like, I couldn't wait to get out of the change room. I think it's just where I'm at in life, but I was like, I couldn't wait to get out of the change room because I was sick of hearing about rugby.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I think it made me appreciate when I was playing more, though. I was very happy playing, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's just important. And you obviously having Dills and Spice, right?
Yeah, Spice. Yeah.
Spice on board. Like, you're bouncing ideas off each other.
Yeah.
And you've that's got... good. Yeah, very, very driven mindsets to it all.
It's nice to come home and have something something else to focus on. I think as a rugby player, you can overthink very easily, and you know the people that say they're overthinkers, they believe they're overthinkers, so
yeah.
They do it even more, like as we've spoken about. But having a distraction, having something to, and not to worry about whilst you're there, because when you're playing rugby, you just have to think about rugby. It's too intense an environment not to. But I've obviously friendly with Navs, and we get on very well, because when we leave rugby, we don't talk about rugby.
Talk about rugby, yeah.
We just, it's not brought up. Like, me and Dills would talk about scrums, but that to us isn't rugby. That's like the enjoyment.
That's like some weird porn to you guys.
Generally, yeah. We like take it apart and have a good old. That around that, but I think that 80-20 kind of ratio.
Yeah,
you know, you have to be full on with rugby. I don't disagree with it. When you're there, you're there. But having something to help you switch off, boys quite often will play better once they've got kids. That's no coincidence. That's not because they want to do it for the kids. Okay, it might be because they want to solidify something for the kids, but actually when you get home, you've got another job to do.
Switch off.
And you've got to switch off, because you can't take, if you have a shit day in rugby, you can't take it home to your kid. Your kid doesn't, take the hand board. So, I think having something, and obviously a business is a good way of doing it, because it sets you up for a transition, and even if, the business fails, you you've learned something.
Learned
like,
something.
The second business will be a little bit better. Or
yeah, that's true. It's literally like can't screw up.
Yeah.
Can't screw up coffee.
All over, yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you as well, like, it's up to you how much you want to share, but from our perspective, you know, when we originally connected, we were at the wedding, actually, Callum's wedding, weren't we?
Wedding, yeah.
And, you know, what was it that, you know, were you interested in starting this journey with getting into a mindset coach?
I think, so at the start, it was getting to London with nobody to be accountable to. It was obviously a fresh start, and I didn't want to waste that opportunity, and obviously I'd had a chat to you and obviously know you from a little bit further back than, you know, just the wedding, but the structure that I've been able to put together now just keeps me focused on like a daily basis rather than everything would be match based back home in Cardiff. I'd, you know, come home and have the dog to look after, which and missus, and we got family to please, and there's always jobs on the list and the business. So it was very much a full plate, whereas in London I still have half the week with the family, but I've got those like first 3 or 4 days of the week to just focus on me, and I didn't want to waste that. So for me it was identifying what goals I wanted to achieve, but then these like small little habits, so like we do our like habit stacking, and the habits I had before still go, but these new habits that I find harder to put into place, I'm accountable to myself because I've got them on my sheet, like my little book, and being grateful is a big one. I think sometimes as blokes we're quite naive, almost not writing our thoughts down or not saying our thoughts out loud, and we think that that's, you know, okay, and we can manage without doing it, but writing the things that we're grateful for, the things that we appreciate down, actually just reinforces the good things in life, and a lot of that isn't the things we think it is.
Yeah.
I reckon 50% of mine is my partner, if not more, and there's another 20% that's a dog. Like, it's just like the little things that day that make your day, and then registering it. So for me, after I learn by writing, I learn by planning things out and ticking it off my list, and I know a lot of your other clients do the same, and then when you become autonomous, you become it becomes an easy thing to do, and then you see the compounding, and then you see these effects at the end of it. So I know with my like work, my like other, not Fat Dragon, but my other stuff, I find I put the side quite often because I was never accountable for it. I would do it freelance and I'd be like, right, I can help you with this and we'll do this, and for me, having it written down, being accountable to myself, and then our weekly little catch-ups, that's been a bit of a game changer for me, to be honest, and it's been good to give me direction.
We've been working a lot on, I loved everything you said then, first and foremost, but we were working a lot on, you know, saying no to things.
Yeah.
He's got the stage now, he doesn't text me back. So
Hey, it's a tough one now. It is,
mate, because I'm like, my background is people pleasing. And like we talked about, you know, we identify by things like overthinking, and we say it, and then we are it, then we create this extra person. But for me, man, people pleasing was something wired in me from childhood, from my parents. But then knowing that, you know, it feels good to help others. But then it's like, why do I feel burnt out? Why do I feel exhausted? This shouldn't be happening for that reason.
Yeah.
And then learning that it's okay to say no, because it's harder to say no than it is to say yes.
Yeah.
So
you don't want the negative kind of connotations that come with it, do we? But yeah, that's been, sorry, I missed that. But yeah, for me, it was dad. So dad never said no. And then I'd have a go at my old man because he's not saying no. And then actually, when I look at it, I don't say no. I'm doing everything I can. I'll help you this, I'll help you that. And the people obviously come to you then more because they know you won't say no. Or it's not necessarily because you're good at something. It's because you will go and learn. Or for me anyway, it'll be, I'll go and learn and then I'll explain and then you go around in that vicious circle, establish the identity, and then you believe it.
Yeah.
That was for me. I didn't understand that. And when you kind of give me that kind of step process thing, it took it all in. And I was like, shit, you know what?
Yeah,
I've done this to myself. I'm doing as hard, mate.
And it's time, isn't it? It's wired into our brain. But it's that saying, and it's like, cells that wire together fire together. So it's kind of like we got to break thought patterns. And the way we break thought patterns is by rewiring the way we think, act, speak. And then in result of that, we change our personality and change traits and patterns that we identify by. But like the hardest thing about when you break a pattern like that is it's the fear of saying no to someone and them as a people pleaser. It's like learning that, oh, they might not like me now. But when you realize it's not they don't like you no, right now. It's you just never had a boundary. You never made a healthy boundary between people. I'm speaking on my behalf. Yeah. And you know, when you don't have a healthy boundary, people, they're okay to say, oh, I never knew that was pissing you off.
Yeah.
You know, I have so many people that I come across or I've done as well. It's like we make this radical change, but because we make a radical change and putting boundaries in place, it's too intense, too quick. Yeah. And then they're like, whoa, what's up with Brad?
Yeah.
Why is Brad being a hard ass? He's like, no, it's not being a hard ass. He's just gone balls to the wall and putting boundaries in place. And it's interesting. And you know, this is what's taken your performances and training to that next level is, you know, you're really helpful of and thorough with video. Like, you know that, like when it comes to scrummaging, you'll help, you give your input. So it's like, okay, I can give help to the other props. I can give help to the people in my position, but I can't give them help if I'm not helping myself first. And it's that,
that's,
you know,
the number one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like whenever you go on a plane.
Yeah,
have you seen this one? I said the mask story. I was on the plane in France, and the woman, they said, "Oh, wait till the mask to drop. If you're ever in an emergency and the oxygen mask drops, make sure you put yours on first before you help others, because essentially you're dead if you can't help yourself first." And that all comes back to that. So it's kind of identifying that. Like for me, it was identifying that was my mum in me, people pleasing. And then asking yourself why I did that. And then just understanding over time, we're going to make small increments of breaking this pattern.
Yeah.
And feeling okay to say no. Maybe not to the extent where you haven't got back to your sister in like 2 months, mate.
Do you know what was really bad? So I had this op and I'd forgotten. I say forgotten. I did forget. But I hadn't texted my mum to tell her I was on an op. And at the time, I was in my head, I was just like, over and over and over again, I'm going to tell. And I just kind of forgotten to do it because I was off this thing of texting people for the sake of the texting people. I'd made it a habit. And then my own mum was like, I didn't know you had an operation.
It's your first one. Literally, as well.
I know, yeah. So she was probably better off not knowing her way. Yeah. She didn't have time to worry. But it obviously wasn't a bad one. But luckily.
What's currently exciting you now?
Mate, you know, in a weird way, like having the opportunity now to do a bit more like physical work in rugby. So, most people will know, when you're injured, it's quite easy to lose your head and get frustrated. And I think having a bit of a plan, or at least having the mentality of having a plan, has been good. So, I obviously need to work on, say, my upper body as a prop. It's something that you can never have enough of. And so like we're doing, I think I've got like 6 or 7 upper body sessions a week, which are all like meticulously balanced. You obviously can't overdo it, skill stuff. But then putting a plan then in place for like coming back.
Nice.
Like being able to play. So I know my time scale. I know it doesn't really matter if I come back earlier or on the date, because there's no games for me. So that was almost like a bit of a weight.
Relief,
yeah, because I wanted to play as soon as I could. And then it was like, well, if you come back in 8 weeks, there's no game until 12 weeks anyway. So it's like that bit excites me, is that I've got something now to follow, to build up to, get back playing, and then actually really have a chance to like unload that frustration then of being injured for 10, 12 weeks.
Yeah, good stuff. I like that. And the last thing as well is, since we have worked together, you know, have you found, you know, I think growing up, But I always used to think journaling was for girls, like diaries and stuff. Yeah. But like learning that, like, you know, the journaling and meditation and,
yeah,
and, you know, like understanding like how you can build self-confidence and belief in things. Yeah. You know, is that something that's shifted totally now since?
I think so, yeah. I still find certain aspects of it strange. Like I said to you before, I find visualization hard because I think in like in writing. Yeah. Like, I don't think in like the picture kind of side of things, but I think you're losing a lot by not doing it. Even if you just try it, and if you really don't think it doesn't work, you've lost nothing. You've only shared it with yourself for starters. But the journaling part, I think you'd be surprised how many people do it. Obviously, you'd be surprised how many people don't do it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There'll be, you know, in all walks of life, people will do it, and I think it's an easy way of establishing to yourself what you're doing, what your goals are, where you want to go. And it's always good to look back on.
100%.
I looked back on mine the other day and was like, shit, I've done all that.
Yeah.
And you forget about it, don't you? Like, you're in your here and now zone. And
yeah.
I don't mean looking back in a bad way, but, you know, looking back and just taking confidence from it. You know?
Well, dude, man, look, it's been an absolute privilege having you on.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sick of speaking to you every week now. but lastly, mate, just I ask all my guests, what are you grateful for?
Grateful for my family and partner. It's a tough place to be, you know, other side of the UK, but she's a gem and a rock. So,
yeah. Valley girl, see you now.
Valley girl, it's built differently.
Thank you so much, man.
Cheers, pal. Thanks, bud. Don't just talk it, walk it. Walk it only. Don't just talk it, walk it. Don't just talk it, walk it. Just talk it, walk it, walk it on.